is uprising. Good morning and welcome to Uprising. Once a city heralded by the promoters of the North American Free Trade Agreement, Juarez, Mexico has now become a global epicenter of the failed so-called war on drugs. Just across the border from El Paso, Texas, the northern Mexican metropolis home to 1.3 million people has garnered a grittier reputation in recent years as a place where cartels battle for control, murders are rampant, and poverty remains high in the backdrop of hundreds of foreign-owned factories offering wages that can't begin to compete with the allure of drug trafficking. As part of his drug war policy, Mexican President Felipe Calderón dispatched 10,000 soldiers to the city in March 2008. But murders in the city multiplied just the same, as many residents in Juarez want the military gone. The facts and figures of the city's social descent into chaos are staggering. 4 months into the new year, the rate of violent deaths has accelerated upwards, as 686 lives have already been claimed in the maelstrom. Ciudad Juarez could be headed to its deadliest year on record if it eclipses the 2,600 murders that occurred in 2009 alone. The femicide of young women and girls, a social issue that once drew international attention to the city before seemingly being overshadowed in recent years, continues unabated. More than 50 women have been killed this year, their bodies often mutilated, showing signs of torture and abuse. According to the Chihuahua State Human Rights Commission, there are at least 20,000 abandoned houses in Ciudad Juarez and could be as many as 30,000. Privileged residents, fearing being caught in the constant crossfire of violence, have fled across the border in droves to El Paso. Painting this portrait in words, award-winning author and critically acclaimed journalist Charles Bowden plunges deep into the soul of Ciudad Juarez in his new book, Murder City, Ciudad Juarez and the Global Economy's New Killing Fields. With gripping prose, he broadens the understanding of the ongoing violence beyond the headlines of the U.S. and Mexican media's explanations of who is doing the killing and who is doing the dying. Murder City interweaves the story of the city through a myriad of personalities, from a pastor who runs a desert asylum, a reformed killer for hire, and a woman broken by trauma, known only as Miss Sinaloa. Luis Alberto Urrea has said of Bowden's latest work that, quote, there are moments when the book threatens to burst into flames and burn in your hands. I had the chance recently to spend the hour in studio with Charles Bowden to discuss his book, Murder City. Before we talk about the main aspect of your book, which is what has been happening in Juarez since 2008, let's talk about what you refer to as the good old days, sarcastically, of course, how in the 1990s, Juarez saw 200 to 300 murders a year, a place where you said death made sense, if you will. What was that time?
Well, when I first went there and started writing about it in June of 1995, I thought I'd drifted into hell. The city was dominated by a man whose name was never mentioned, Amado Carrillo, who ran the Juarez cartel. DEA intelligence at that time said the Juarez cartel earned $250 million a week. He controlled both all the newspapers, all the radio stations, all the television, you know, and his name was never said in any of the media, nor would people say his name out loud that lived in the city. They'd find bodies on the street wrapped in yellow ribbon or other signatures of his organization. Girls were disappearing mysteriously and being murdered. The city was full of poor people because the maquilas, the border plants, were exploding. They were streaming in. It was growing like a cell. And it was full of dirt and dust. I realize now that that was the good old days because people felt relatively safe, even though the jobs paid nothing. They had jobs. And the murder rate was nothing compared to today. Starting in 2007 was the most violent year in the history of Juarez, and Juarez is almost 350 years old. There were 307 murders. In 2008, it went to 1,660 murders. In 2009, it went to 2,753 murders. And as I sit here this morning, in 2010, there have been 700 murders so far this year. And so everything I knew, and I wrote a book about the drug world and the drug business, called Down by the River, is out of date. I might as well have been writing about antiquity. When this killing started in 2008, I was having coffee in the morning with a friend of mine named Julian Cardona, who lives in Juarez and has lived there all his life. And I think it was about January 20th, three or four state police commandantes were attacked and machine gunned all in a short period of time. And he and I looked at each other and realized we didn't understand anything, that everything we knew now meant nothing. And I'll tell you why, because everybody knew the state police were part of the Juarez cartel, their employees, and why are they getting killed? And so we put down our coffee and drove to Juarez. I had no plan of writing a book. I just thought, I don't know what's going on, and he didn't know what's going on. His photographs illustrate the book Murder City. And, you know, a year later, I finished the book. I didn't plan to write a book. I'll tell you why I wrote the book. I just started writing because this was an explosion of violence without any precedent that I knew. Now, as I sit here, 5,000 people have been slaughtered in that city. And I thought, at that time, the mainstream press was religiously ignoring it. The El Paso paper hardly reported it. I thought, my God, you know, I was trained as a reporter. Some kind of record has to be created. And as time went on, the pages kept piling up. The murders got worse. August 2008, they're having a prayer meeting in a clinic for drug rehabilitation in a very poor barrio. And these people have to go out and sell chiclets on the corner during the day, the people trying to detox, so that the clinic will have enough money to buy food to feed them. There's a prayer meeting. An army truck rolls up. All the people in the barrio saw it. Four guys get out, walk into that clinic. They've got AK-47s. They're in there 15 minutes shooting. They go into the room where the prayer meeting is going on, just at the altar call, when the preacher says those who will accept Christ in their heart, you know, walk to the front and kill them all. And just bodies heaped up. And then they leave. And then the police don't come for over an hour. The ambulances don't come. Nothing's ever done about it. And by that time, I knew this thing had reached a dimension that simply saying corruption or cartel couldn't possibly explain.
What happened to Amado Carrillo, the man who headed the drug cartels
in the
90s?
Amado Carrillo died in July of 1997 in a private hospital in Mexico City, which he owned, undergoing plastic surgery. Exactly how he died is much debated, meaning the debate is who really killed him. His brother, then, Amado Carrillo had run the Juarez cartel for 4 years. He had killed his predecessor in May of 93, died in July of 97. His brother Vicente then took over the cartel and still runs it. He's probably the longest reigning capo in the history of Mexico.
And so can the explosion of killings be at least partly attributed to the new leadership of the Juarez cartel?
I don't think so. Look, there's a bunch of official explanations. The government says it's a battle between the Juarez cartel and the Sinaloa cartel, headed by a man named Chapo Guzman. Well, the only problem with that is if you go to the morgue and look at the 5,000 corpses, most of them are nobodies. They're not cartel members. They're men, women, kids, poor people in barrios. This is preposterous. The Mexican government insists 90% of the dead are sucio, dirty. Well, I think that's preposterous, unless you're very generous with what dirty means. The Mexican government says it's a war between the Mexican army and the cartels. Very interesting war. So far, 23,000 Mexicans have been slaughtered, and the army's lost maybe 100 people. Apparently, the cartels refused to fight back. Now, this is a lot of these crimes increasingly are economic. I mean, your listeners should know that as a result of this war, which was initiated by the president of Mexico when he assumed power to prove he was a strong man, 25% of the houses in Juarez have been abandoned. There's 116,000 abandoned houses. 40% of the businesses have closed. Retail. Everybody that runs any kind of business there, and I mean if you're selling tacos from a cart on the street, is paying extortion. Everybody's being kidnapped. 30 to 60,000 of the affluent members of Juarez, I mean the people that are rich, have moved to El Paso across the river. 100,000 factory jobs in the maquiladoras have left town. By any rational description, the city's dying, and every month the murders climb. In January of 2008, the city was electrified because I believe there were 44 murders, an unprecedented number. Now the city of Juarez would think peace broke out if they had a month with 100 murders.
Mm. Now, most of the reporting in the earlier part of the decade around Juarez has been about the murders of women in Juarez, and there have been plays written about it. And you say that only about 10 to 12% of those killed are women in Juarez who have violent deaths, and that those deaths are easily explained.
Okay, I'll make this simple. Mm-hmm. Historically, the murder rate of women in Mexico, if you take all the states in the country, is about 10%. Historically, the murder rate of women in Juarez is about 10%, meaning if you take all the dead people in a year, about 10% are women. Since this explosion of violence, it's gone down to 6%. There are numerically more women being killed. Because more of everybody being killed. There's also more 10-year-olds being killed. But the percentage has declined. The second thing is, this has become a kind of cottage industry. A gender scholar I correspond with, who's doing a dissertation on this, told me there had been 17 films made about the murder of women. They generally give a statistic, like there have been, in a 15-year period, 400 women were killed. That is completely correct. But if you go into the records, two-thirds to three-quarters of the women killed every year are killed by husbands and lovers. In other words, whether that is justice, whether there's ever the perpetrators are ever put in jail, it is not a mystery. We know who killed them. Usually the guy sitting there drunk after murdering his wife, just as in the States. Mm-hmm. That leaves one-quarter to one-third that are not explained. Now, the people that focus on this issue say there's never been an investigation of these murders. Murders aren't investigated in Mexico. Going back to these numbers I recited earlier, there were 2,753 people murdered in 2009 in Juarez. There were 30 arrests for homicide, not convictions, arrests. Now, I'm not saying women should be killed, men should be killed, children should be killed. But you're looking at a justice system that simply doesn't exist. You're looking at a forensic capacity that doesn't exist. And so in this peculiar, you have a peculiar circumstance where the one way women get, treated equally with men in Juarez is if they get murdered, nobody does a damn thing about it. But what one should look at is this explosion of violence that's killing everyone. This what's killing these people in the end is the city. A city with corrupt cops, a city with slave wages, and I mean slave wages. The turnovers in these American-owned factories is 100 to 200% a year. In a city of poverty, that should tell you all you need to know about these jobs.
Yeah. I'm speaking with Charles Bowden. He's the author of 11 books, including Down by the River, Drugs, Money, Murder, and Family, as well as Juarez, The Laboratory of Our Future, and Some of the Dead Are Still Breathing, his latest, Murder City, Ciudad Juarez, and the Global Economy's New Killing Fields. We're talking about that book. Let's talk about NAFTA, the role of NAFTA, these maquiladoras that has had some coverage, at least here in the United States, in terms of the role they play in the global economy. How much of what NAFTA did to Mexico's economy plays into, if you can even sort of understand, into these killings in Juarez?
I think NAFTA, either deliberately or inadvertently, created the premise for the breakdown of Mexican society. NAFTA, by opening the free trade agreement, by opening Mexico to American agribusiness products, destroyed peasant agriculture in Mexico. NAFTA kicked in 1994, and within 18 months of that, you see an explosion of apprehension rates by the Border Patrol. And what that means simply is the Mexican poor started moving north because they couldn't survive. NAFTA destroyed small industry in Mexico. because it had been sheltered by a tariff wall, and it simply couldn't compete with U.S., Canadian, and Asian products. All these things destabilized the country. NAFTA was promised by then-President Bill Clinton to solve illegal immigration. Instead, it created what I think most scholars agree is the largest human migration going on this planet today. NAFTA is a disaster. Now, one of the things Americans in particular refuse to ever say out loud is that there's any association between crime and poverty, a premise I find rather absurd. I know of no one who's ever won the lottery and said, I'm going to move to a poor neighborhood now so I'll be safe. But of course it creates. When you thwart human dreams, their ability to feed their families, their ability to have electricity, water, security, it leads to violence. Juarez is a city that for two or three generations now, even before NAFTA with these border plants, has produced almost a feral population of kids, and I'd like to dwell on this for a moment. In this city of over a million, there's one high school for every 500,000 inhabitants. These high schools are not free. You have to pay to go to them. It means we've raised several generations in Juarez of kids whose parents work for miserable wages in these factories. They're latchkey kids in our parlance. And they 50% of the adolescents in Juarez neither have a job nor in school. There are 500 to 900 street gangs now. This is a recipe for death. Now, I can't explain precisely why the violence suddenly erupted in 2008, but I can say it was inevitable. Now, the second thing creating this hell in Juarez and in much of Mexico is the American war on drugs.
Plan Mexico.
Well, look at this, all over Mexico. Look at the American war on drugs, the war promulgated by the United States government, has created the largest cash flow now in Mexico. The drug industry, meaning what we call cartels, a fictional term, earns Mexico $30 to $50 billion a year in hard currency, probably as much as oil, which is their leading source of foreign currency. This is flowing into, you know, gangster hands. It is because of the United States' effort to repeal a market economy. Americans want to consume drugs. Mexicans supply them. It's that simple. Passing a law against it merely raises the price. Basically, anybody that gets into the production of what we call narcotics finds out they're very cheap to make. You know, that the only way they have real value is to be illegal. Just like beer is not very expensive to make, but Al Capone got rather wealthy when it was outlawed in Prohibition. So you have to face the fact, besides the damage we're doing to ourselves, we're slowly becoming a police state, lest anyone roll a joint or do a line of coke. We have the largest per capita prison population on Earth. It's incredibly damaging to the Mexican people, because these gangs with guns are everywhere, and they're living off drug money.
So how do the drugs get into the United States? Because we reportedly have a Border Patrol force that is, there to at least stop immigrants from coming in, but presumably drugs ought to be stopped as well.
Well, look, we got 10 to 15 million illegal Mexicans here. Let's say the basic unit's 120 pounds. They get through all these barriers, too. Kilo weighs 2.2 pounds, but I'll answer your question directly. The drugs come into the United States by being put on trucks and driven across the bridge and going through U.S. Customs. The untold story is the scale of the corruption. There's so much money in drugs that you can buy people. I did an interview with a guy in the Juarez cartel who ran 2 tons of marijuana a week to Miami, and he did it for years. And he drove it right over the bridge through U.S. Customs because he bought a couple customs agents. And he never lost a load.
So U.S. customs agents are being bribed.
Of course.
Mm-hmm.
Look, we've created an impossible situation. We take decent people out of basically blue-collar families. We put them in Homeland Security, the Border Patrol, U.S. Customs. Yeah, they start out 35 grand a year, and 5 years they're making 75 government benefits, and somebody comes up there and says, it's a huge wad of money. Yeah, you just wave one truck through, you're waving them through all day. Here's 500,000 or 100,000, or it doesn't matter. People become corrupted, and the mistake people make when they talk about corruption or think about it is they think the whole agency is corrupt. That's not cost-effective. If you're moving a semi-load of dope, you just need the person who waves the semi through. You don't have to bribe everyone. Now, I'll tell you another anecdote. I have a friend of the Border Patrol who's been in many, many years. And he works in a station along the border with 350 other Border Patrol agents. This is increasingly common. They're growing like mushrooms out there. And I asked him how many people he worked with he trusted. We're having a drink. And he fell silent. And he said, none. And he meant it, because the agency has grown so fast. He doesn't know who these people are. He can sense things going on. They busted a Border Patrol guy in Arizona who was charging $500 a load to run drugs in his trunk, his Border Patrol car, 70 miles from the border to Tucson, because he go through the checkpoint. Mm. Now, what I want to make this point, I think the system isn't being victimized by corrupt people. It's creating corrupt people. It's putting people in a situation where they know damn well when they get off work, wherever they live, they're going to go home and there's going to be drugs in the neighborhood anyway. This thing isn't working. I don't know of any place in this country where there's a panic, as they used to say in Needle Park. The drugs are everywhere, and they just finally get burnt out and say, why not take the money? And they also, this happens with people smuggling, the same thing. I mean, good God, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people get through every year. Why not take some money for the 50 that move through tonight, you know, because they're going to get through eventually? And so people succumb. That's how it gets here. But the real reason it gets here is there's a market. That's why drug guys dig tunnels under the border and do everything. It'll always get here.
I'm speaking with Charles Bowden about his book, Murder City, Ciudad Juarez and the Global Economy's New Killing Fields. Let's trace the money that U.S. taxpayers foot for Plan Mexico and where that, how that money eventually affects people in Juarez.
Well, it's very simple. President George Bush, initiated a plan to help the Mexican army fight drugs. It's called Plan Merida, and we give them $500 million a year. The Mexican army takes the money and kills Mexicans. That's what happens. I don't think the Mexican army is fighting the drug world. That's why none of the soldiers die. They're fighting a war for drugs. Now, another character, I think the Mexican army personally is the largest criminal organization in Mexico. In Juarez alone, there's hundreds and hundreds of human rights complaints. And these complaints are not easy to make, meaning you file a complaint against the army, and there's 11,000 soldiers and federal agents now in Juarez. They're going to come looking for you. It takes guts. Now, these complaints are not, I got dissed by a soldier. These complaints are a soldier murdered my son, or a soldier raped me, or a soldier robbed my house, or a soldier kidnapped my husband and tortured him. These are not petty. Now, the government has an official human rights representative in Juarez named Gustavo de la Rosa Hickerson. He files these complaints. His reward is that he now has to live in El Paso as a fugitive because the Mexican army is going to kill him. I don't know why the U.S. government doesn't know these things. This is not a secret, like some rumor, that this is a fiasco, what we're doing. So, now, one last point, and I'll stop nattering. According to U.S. Army intelligence out of Leavenworth, our big fort in Kansas, they did a study. And in a six-year period, there's 250,000 soldiers in the Mexican Army, 150,000 deserted. The U.S. Army believes almost all of them deserted not to go home and drink lemonade, but to join drug cartels. Because you get to carry a gun there, you get to kill people, rape them and torture them, and the pay is a lot better. Which is one of the sources, I believe, of this fabled river of iron, the guns. Do you think, how many people listening to this think, I'm going to desert the Mexican army, I'm going to join the drug cartel, but I won't take my gun with me?
So it's the Mexican army, it's drug cartels, many of whom are, you know, formerly members of the Mexican army. What about state and federal police, local police?
Well, they've always, well, in Juarez in particular, they've always been corrupt.
But they're also being killed, some of them.
Yes, because It's a war for drugs. Like, the state police and the municipal police in Juarez traditionally worked for the Juarez cartel. Now the federal police and the army are there. The army is technically in control now of the city police. And they're killing them. The city police held a demonstration in May of 2008 wearing masks, insisting that the army stop kidnapping them and torturing them and raping them.
And there's a picture of that in your book.
Right. I mean, this is what is happening. Now, the second thing is, there are, like, our government says we will try and reform the Mexican police. Look, there are 3,500 police forces in Mexico. They've all cut their own deals. It's a famous thing. You have a choice of silver and lead. You either cooperate with criminal organizations, drug organizations, or we kill you. The solution won't work. That's why we keep having drug czars and special commandantes in Mexico and then find out they work for the drug cartel. They like to live.
Charles Bowden, in writing your book, you turned this not into sort of a analysis that focuses just on policy and history, but you made it into a book about people and characters, in particular a small handful of characters. Why did you delve into the soul of the city rather than focus on policy numbers analysis?
Because people ignore policies. Because if I tell your listeners 5,000 people have died, it's a number. If I make them feel one death, they'll remember it. That's why the most powerful play in modern American history is called Death of a Salesman, not Errors of Capitalism. It was a simple decision. I wanted to make people feel it. A modern city that was supposed to be the poster child for our free trade policies, the sister city of El Paso, is dying before our eyes. And I want people to feel it on every level. There are facts in the book, but I'm not a policy guy. Policies are what a murdered war is.
Well, I'm wondering if you can read from your book.
Well, there's no big words.
For our listeners, you have a sort of, your chapter headings are interesting. You have recurring chapters with the name Dead Reporter Driving, about focusing on one of the handful of characters in your book, Emilio Gutierrez Soto.
Yes. He's a Mexican reporter trying to get political asylum in the United States, and he only has one problem. The Mexican army is trying to murder him. Okay, the reporter may die for committing a simple error. He wrote an accurate news story. He did not know this was dangerous because he thought the story was small and unimportant. He was wrong, and that was the beginning of all his trouble. This is because there are two Mexicos. There is the one reported by the U.S. press, a place where the Mexican president is fighting a valiant war against the evil forces of the drug world and using the incorruptible Mexican army as his warriors. This Mexico has newspapers, courts, and laws, and is seen by the U.S. government as a sister republic. It does not exist. There is a second Mexico, where the war is for drugs, for the enormous money to be made in drugs, where the police and the military fight for their share, where the press is restrained by the murder of reporters and feasts on a steady diet of bribes, and where the line between government and the drug world has never existed. The reporter lives in the second Mexico. Until very recently, he liked it just fine. In fact, he loved it because he loves Mexico and has never thought of leaving. Even though he lives near the border, he has not bothered to cross for almost 10 years. But now things have changed. He has researched the humanitarian treaties signed by the United States, and he thinks, given these commitments by the American government, he and his 15-year-old boy will be given asylum. He has decided to tell the authorities nothing but the truth. His research has failed to uncover one little fact. No Mexican reporter has ever been given political asylum by the United States of America. Suddenly, he sees a checkpoint ahead, and there's no way to escape it. Men in uniforms pull him over. He is frightened, but he discovers to his relief that this checkpoint is run by the Mexican Migration Service, and so maybe they will not give him up to the army. Why are you driving so fast? I'm afraid. These people are trying to kill me. The narcos? No, the soldiers. Who are you? hands over his press pass. Ah, oh, you're the one. They searched your house. I've had some problems. Those sons of bitches do whatever they want. Go ahead. Good luck. He roars away. When he stops at the U.S. port of entry and at Antelope Wells in the Boot Heel of New Mexico, U.S. Customs asks, as they always do, what is he bringing from Mexico? He says, we bring fear. And after that, we sent him to prison for 7 months as a menace to our country, and we sent his boy to prison for 2 months as a menace to our country. Now he's out pending a political asylum case. If he wins, you'll be the first.
Charles Bowden, reading from his book about one of the reporters in Mexico who dared to briefly tell the truth and has been paying the price. Reporters have been murdered at
alarming
rates.
The book's dedicated to a dead reporter. Armando Rodriguez, he worked for Diario de Juarez, the major daily in Juarez. He was murdered November 13th, 2008, in front of his home at 8:30 in the morning. He's warming up his car. His 8-year-old daughter's sitting beside him. He's going to take her to school. Guys walk up and just blow him away in his car. The girl survives. The day Armando Rodriguez died, he had filed 907 homicide stories already that year. But this case has never been investigated, has never been solved, and never will be solved. He's one of the many casualties of what's going on in Mexico.
My guest is Charles Bowden, critically acclaimed journalist, award-winning author of 11 books, including Murder City, Ciudad Juarez, and The Global Economy's New Killing Fields, which we've just been discussing. We're going to take a short break for today's Subversive Historian, and when we come back, part two of our interview.
This is Gabriel San Roman, your subversive historian. Back in the day on April 26, 1937, the civilians of Guernica were terror-bombed from above during the Spanish Civil War. German and Italian bomber planes, at the behest of fascist general Francisco Franco, attacked the cultural capital of the Basque people for more than 3 hours. The onslaught wrought much death and destroyed three-quarters of a town where no legitimate military target could be claimed. Franco denied responsibility for the aerial attacks that caused deaths estimated to be in the hundreds. Beyond doubt, however, the fascist general authored the bombings to terrorize the symbolic center of a population that resisted his nationalist forces. The atrocities committed that day led famous Spanish artist Pablo Picasso to interpret the horrors of war in his now iconic Guernica painting. 66 years later, a reproduction of his work was concealed by a blue drape in the United Nations as then Secretary of State Colin Powell gave a historic speech inside justifying the impending U.S. invasion of Iraq. The painting's power to shame the warmongers, however, was apparent for all to see. For Uprising, this is your truth professor saying it's no mystery why they conceal our people's history.
You're listening to Uprising. I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar. We turn now to part two of my interview with Charles Bowden, critically acclaimed journalist, award-winning author of 11 books, his latest being Murder City, Ciudad Juarez, and The Global Economy's New Killing Fields. Let's talk about Miss Sinaloa, another of the characters in your book, a woman who figures right from the first part of your book. Who is she? What happened to her? And how is she involved, or how does her story illuminate this the murders in Juarez?
Oh, Miss Sinaloa, her real name is not given, was a beauty queen from the state of Sinaloa. Sinaloa is the, let's say, the Harvard of major drug figures in Mexico. Most of them come from there. She was brought to Juarez for a party. Which is common in Mexico. You fly in beautiful women, you're going to have a big party. The party didn't turn out the way she wanted. She was in a kind of resort hotel, and she was raped for 3 days and nights by Mexican police. Because of this experience, and, she was, just a wreck, She lost her mind. I think because she became crazy, they didn't kill her. There's a history there of disposing of women like Kleenexes after these parties. A friend of mine is an evangelical minister, a Mexican from a poor barrio who converted to Christ and built with his own hands a kind of insane asylum for the damaged of the city, on the edge of the city. No running water. At that time, it had no electricity. They dumped her out there. He eventually brought her around after months, and she recovered her mind and went back to her family in Sinaloa. She's still a little addled, but, you know. I put her in the book because I thought this is what the city does to people. It destroys people. It destroys you if you're a punk cholo kid who's going to get murdered. It destroys you if you work in a factory. It destroys you if you're the beautiful woman who comes for a party. It destroys you now if you're a drug addict. Mexican clinicians estimate there are 200,000 drug addicts in Juarez. Look at this city in 3 years has produced 10,000 orphans. That's the crop. Because their parents have been murdered.
And this is a city of how many people?
Well, we don't know. They used to say 1.5 to 2 million. Now most serious people think it's down to 1 million. They don't know how many have left. Estimates vary from 100,000 to 400,000. It's a city collapsing. But it's also, it used to have 200,000 feral street dogs. Now there's a lot more because people flee and can't take their pets with them. This is a new kind of reality, not one that was ever told to us by the proponents of free trade, not one that was ever told to us by Just Say No in the war on drugs, but this is the actual product of the policies, not the imaginary one.
Now, the friend of yours that you mentioned who runs this insane asylum.
Yes, Pastor Galvan.
Yeah, or El
who
Pastor.
Who prays for
is
me.
You.
God bless him. God have mercy on him.
Tell us about him and what motivates him. He's another of the people who you explain and who you go in depth in your book.
He was raised in a very poor, rough barrio in Juarez. He was trained to be a thief. They had a school. They would have a mannequin there with little bells on it. You'd be taught, you start at 6 or 7 to learn how to pick pockets. He then became an illegal, went to L.A., learned to walk high steel, made real money. He was then thrown in a U.S. prison because he had a disagreement with a fellow employee on the 7th floor walking a beam and threw him off it, which is not a good career move. Then he was kicked out of prison and sent back to Juarez. He was a drunk and a drug addict. He lived on the street for 2 or 3 years, and then he had a conversion experience. And he decided to dedicate himself to street people. He became a born-again Christian, and he collects people off the street who have been destroyed by sniffing glue and paint, go-go dancers that have lost their minds after too many parties, gang guys that have been destroyed by drugs and beatings. He's got over 100 people out there. Among them was Miss Sinaloa. And he raises all the money on his own to feed them. Sometimes he has medicine, sometimes he doesn't. But I want your listeners to know he's not in competition with mental health facilities. He is it. This is the residue of the city. These destroyed people, and he's the only thing they've got. It's not like, why don't you go to the state hospital? That's why the cops bring street people out there and just dump them, because there's no place else to put them. So for me, even though we have our minor theological differences, he's a living saint. Just like one of the people in the book died Christmas morning at 6 a.m., Esther Chavez Cano. She was a woman who noticed the abuse of women, the murders of the girls in the 90s, and she started the first women's shelter in Juarez for raped and battered women, Casa Amiga. And she raised the money for it. And last year it treated 30,000 people because the state doesn't provide the facilities. So she's another saint to me. She created Sucre for 30,000 brutalized women.
And then there's an interesting character that you profile in your book, the murder artist.
Yeah, I called in a lot of favors, but the Sicario, the contract killer, is a continuing figure in the book. Look, if I explain this briefly, it'll tell the listeners a lot about the city. He was recruited by the Juarez cartel because he was a street punk to go to the police academy and become a state policeman. They paid him $1,000 a month back in the early 90s. Then he becomes a state police commandante. He's trained by the U.S. FBI because he's a bright student. But where he really is works for the Juarez cartel. He becomes the head of the anti-kidnapping unit in Juarez, a major city in Mexico. But in fact, he is the kidnapper. When he gets calls, my husband has been kidnapped, he's the guy who's kidnapped him. He also becomes a contract killer. He's probably killed 500 people. And he does torture. And he does this for 20 years for the cartel. He personally knew Vicente Carrillo, etc. That he has been around. And now he has a contract on his head for $250,000. The Juarez cartel. Mm-hmm. He stole some money. You know, they don't like that. He's a fugitive. I won't tell you where he is. But to my knowledge, and I could be corrected, he is the only Sicario I know of that's ever gone on the record. We talked for days and days and days. And what he taught me was the intricacies of the system, not simply the cartel, the relationship between it and the government and the army. He was deserving, at one point, delivering suitcases of cash to the Attorney General of Chihuahua every week, the law enforcement arm, etc. And, of course, he did these horrific killings of torture. He personally knows where there are 600 corpses in secret graves around the city, what they call death houses. So that's why he's in the book. This is what, these people aren't being killed by meteor showers. This is institutional violence. Functionally, even though this guy was a cartel member, he works for the state, too. He is the face of power in Mexico.
And I suppose that's one of the main points, if not the main point in your book, is the complete blurring or even overlapping between the major drug cartels in Mexico, the Mexican army, which gets money from the United States, U.S. taxpayers. And essentially, would you say that we are funding the killing of Mexicans?
To a degree, yes. I mean, to the degree we're giving money to law enforcement there, we're funding death. Increasingly, the murders in Juarez are poor people. This is a war on the poor. That the Mexican government has two ways to get rid of poor people: starve them out so they migrate to the United States and send money home, or just kill them. They're in Plan B at the moment. It's almost like social cleansing. And we endorse it, and we lie about it. And we don't even pay any attention to the death till March 13th, when three people associated with the U.S. consulate in Juarez are murdered in broad daylight. Then the Secretary of Defense, then the Secretary of Homeland Security, then the Secretary of State fly to Mexico City and say, "You're doing such a great job, we're going to give you more money and guns." 5,000 dead Mexicans in the city, men, women, and children, never catches our attention, because we believe they're all dirty. And frankly, if our government leaders think these dead people are narco-traficantes or big drug people, then our government is too stupid to continue breathing.
Yeah. I'm speaking with Charles Bowden. He is an author, and a journalist. He's written 11 books. His latest is Murder City. It's about Ciudad Juarez. And we're talking about that book. Now, the explanations about how to understand all of this killing are quite complex. I understand that you had an interview with the mayor of...
No, I didn't.
But there was an interview.
I'm the one guy who's never talked to the mayor. Everybody else talks to him.
He's
got a lot of time since he's not running the city.
He lives in El Paso, which is
just
bizarre.
Correct.
He's the mayor of Juarez.
The publisher of the Juarez Daily newspaper lives in El Paso also. They don't want to die.
Now, how do elected officials like him and other major figures in Juarez and other Mexican cities figure into all of this? Are they also involved in the cartels and the armies?
Well, I can't speak to individuals, but obviously, if they were fighting the largest industry in town, they'd be dead. Period. You know, they couldn't survive. That they figure into it. Partly by lying. The mayor of Juarez, in early June of 2008, when over 500 people had been slaughtered already, said only 4 or 5 of them were innocent. I don't know what he's got, a third eye or something, he can tell. I mean, these people are irrelevant in a sense. They're the mask of power. That he's already turned a city over to the Mexican army. They are the police force. They're increasingly the government. So I guess he was just in Austin saying most of the people, over 90% of the people who have been killed are dirty. Well, look at it. He either is feeble-minded or he's a pathological liar.
One of the aspects of your book that you touch upon I found very fascinating, which is the Zetas. Who are the Zetas, and why are they a model for today's killers?
Well, they're a model for U.S. policy. In the mid-90s, in order to salvage Mexico under President Cedillo, the U.S. trained this incorruptible police force of Mexicans. And then, frankly, they went on the payroll of DEA secretly. But they didn't like the arrangement down there. I actually knew the DEA agent that paid them. You know, was their paymaster. And so they left and joined the Gulf cartel. And so they became this huge paramilitary influence. They were superbly, they're like Green Berets. Now they're independent. They've taken over a lot of the functions of the Gulf cartel. And they kill everybody with great skill. They also have recruitment posters. They've hung banners in cities to call this number. We have better benefits than the government offers. Look, this war has gotten extremely grotesque. It's very common now for people to have their heads cut off, their arms cut off. I won't go into it, but I mean, this barbarism's a mild word. El Pastor, my hero, my friend who tends to the poor, prays every night that when they come for him, and they've come for him several times, that they'll just murder him and not torture him first. That's the new form of prayer in wars.
How many instances in your researching of this book did you come across of people who, despite these risks, are at least speaking out, I suppose, like journalists or even activists, about what's happening there?
More and more. It's getting more dangerous to speak. It's almost fatal. And yet, it's happening. Like Esther Chavez, who died Christmas Day, was a very small woman. I mean, she was suffering from cancer at the time, but she was always a small, petite woman. And she had that mayor terrified. He'd pretend he wasn't in his office when she showed up. But I'll tell you the most moving story to me. January 31st, a bunch of working-class parents hosted a fiesta for their kids because the kids had won a soccer championship, and they didn't want them going to a public place because they could be killed. The city's too dangerous. So they held it in a house in a working-class barrio, and gunmen showed up and killed 15 kids, just machine-gunned them all.
Why?
In the photograph, well, who the hell knows? In the photographs, there's literally puddles of blood in the street in front of the house because it just ran off the floors out to the street. The president of Mexico, all seen, all wise, at that very moment was in Tokyo when he learned of the slaughter of 15 juveniles. He announced in Tokyo that they were all drug-connected gang kids. Now, these parents in a city with really no education had killed themselves to put these kids in high school. You have to pay. One of the kids was in college. This caused a huge uproar in the city. It was like, finally, basta, enough. We can't stand any more of these lies. So the president of Mexico, a week or so later, flew to Juarez to address the population. Now, what that meant was, it was like Dick Cheney time. He secreted himself in an auditorium in a hotel, surrounded with military troops and police, and had a selected audience. Somehow, the mother of one of these dead kids got in. She lost two sons. And suddenly, while the president's giving this pontification, like, I won't criticize Mexican presidents, like all presidents do, she stood up. Her name was Luz Dávila, poor woman. She said, Mr. President, you're not welcome here. You're not welcome in this city. What you said about my sons are a lie. She said, if your son were killed, you'd turn over every stone in Mexico to get justice. And then she turned her back and stood there with her back to the president of Mexico and didn't say another goddamn word.
Wow.
Now, look, that's more guts than General Patton or any other John Wayne. So, look, Mexican people are like American people. Some of them are good, some of them are bad, you know? They're just people. But they're under a stress. Americans can't even imagine. So what that woman did is extraordinary. That's like Rosa Parks kept her bus seat.
Charles Bowden, at the end of your book, Murder City, you give an appendix of translated news clippings regarding murders in Juarez and it was a difficult task for you and the person who helped you compile it. Both of you noted stopping at various times. Why end the book with this? And will it be as difficult for the reader to read through constant accounts of brutal murders?
I don't think anyone will ever be able to read that appendices. It was created by Molly Malloy, who's a Latin American specialist at New Mexico State University in Las Cruces. But I think readers will start to read it. And I think if they read 2 or 3 days and then realize this could go on for years, instead of numbers that 1,600 were killed that year, if they read these case by case, it'll become real to them. It'll become real to them how horrific this is, and it'll become real to them that these people getting killed are just average people. This isn't the five families in New York. This isn't the Godfather. This is slaughter. So that's why it's there, to convey to people what it really feels like day to day. To live in a city where sometimes 15 people are executed in a day, where the average now is almost 7 per day. That's the purpose of the list. Now, the list only runs for 4 months, because it would be the size of a phone book. It's 15,000 words now, just these little tombstone stories. Name, 7 bullets in the head, June 3rd, something, you know.
And many murders are not even given that much recognition.
No, and people disappear or never reported. And the people that come out of the ground from secret death houses aren't counted in the total. The first 4 months of 2008, 46 bodies came out of secret death houses, but the state doesn't tally them as part of the carnage because they don't know which day they were killed. Counting rules, you see.
Well, finally, Charles Bowden, what should Americans do with the information, you think, that you've put out in the book? Because the United States' role here is, you know, you can't miss it. And it seems like to affect any kind of change, both in the city of Juarez and in Mexico and the border killings, one has to tackle the entire economic policy of the United States.
That's not a bad idea. I'm game. Look at it. I'll give practical things that American citizens can do, and I'm an American citizen. Demand our government renegotiate the North American Free Trade Agreement so that it guarantees unions, guarantees environmental protection, meaning non-polluting plants for workers, and guarantees decent wages for workers. Secondly, demand our officials revisit what they call the war on drugs. It's 40 years old. It's a total failure. It's created the largest per capita prison population on earth. It has not stemmed drugs, and it's murdering the Mexican people. And finally, try and find somebody in this country with enough guts to say we should discuss legalizing drugs. We're killing ourselves outlawing them. Now, people will say that's impossible. We'll never do that. Well, I'm 64 years old, and now I have major politicians endorsing gay marriage. Things change. I have no patience with people saying it's hopeless. I've never seen a bird in the spring that didn't build a nest. We should at least have the courage of a damn bird.
Charles Bowden, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
I've been speaking with Charles Bowden, critically acclaimed journalist, award-winning author of nearly a dozen books. His latest is Murder City, Ciudad Juarez and the Global Economy's New Killing Fields, which we've been discussing this hour. For Sonali Subversive Thought for the Day, Sophocles is known to have said, "There is no witness so terrible, no accuser so powerful, as conscience which dwells within us." That's Sonali's Subversive Thought for the Day. You've been listening to Uprising. Gabriel San Roman is our assistant producer. Teddy Robinson is our engineer. You can order a copy of today's show at 1-800-735-0230 or at pacificaradioarchives.org. Join us at facebook.com/uprisingradio, follow us at twitter.com/uprisingradio, and email us at mail@uprisingradio.org. Listen to the show online and find links, local events, and other information at kpfk.org/uprising. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kolhatkar. Thanks so much for listening. See you tomorrow at 8, and stay tuned for Democracy Now! I didn't wanna sit profound, didn't wanna sit profound.